Caught between the threat of Vladimir Putin's Russia and the wavering of Donald Trump's United States, can Europe really rely on its only two nuclear powers to guarantee deterrence? We'll review the joint announcement by video link out of Northwood Military Base in England to leaders in Rome, gathered for a so-called Coalition of the Willing Summit on Ukraine. Ukraine, which has to think on its own two feet after yet another sleepless night of deadly bombardments and a week of off-and-on shipments of U.S. air defense supplies, back on to express annoyance at Moscow's clear disinterest in Donald Trump's mediation offers. On that score, the chattering classes often speculate about Trump's rationale, but what about the master of the Kremlin? This in the wake of his transport minister meeting an unfortunate end, first fired and found dead of an apparent suicide, and where other high-profile insiders have also learned that they'd been purged. Are the leaders in Rome and in Northwood ready for what's next? Today in the France 24 debate, we're talking about deterrence made in Europe. With us, retired French general Dominique Trinquant. Thank you for being with us.
Good evening.
Anastasia Shapochkina is president of the Eastern Circles think tank, also lecturer in geopolitics at the French Political Science Institute, Sciences Po. Good to see you.
Thank you.
From when she's not hosting France 24's Scene from Russia segment, senior correspondent Elena Voloshin films documentaries, and she writes books, one's called Propaganda, Vladimir Putin's Weapon of War. Welcome to the show again.
Thank you.
And from Brussels, in a previous life, he worked at NATO's policy planning unit. Giuseppe Spatafora is research analyst at the European Union Institute for Security Studies. Welcome.
Hey, thank you.
Reminder, if you're on the go, you can listen to the show wherever podcasts are streamed. We sometimes forget on a sunny Thursday in July here in Paris that there's a war on in Europe. Dateline, Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, overnight.
Что-то мне этот звук не нравится.
Бля.
Ложитесь.
Yeah, and that is just one scene from Instagram that was picked up there by the Reuters news agency. Anastasia Shapochkina, we see every night now in the last week, every night. This was the biggest night ever of drone attacks. What's it all about, and how are people there coping? Mm.
Well, everybody's extremely exhausted, right? I mean, physically, people are not sleeping for fourth year in a row. And this is very kind of sad to realize that the U.S. has also dumped Ukraine, as it has dumped many of its allies before. We have seen yet another turnaround.
Dumped Ukraine?
Well, because, see, last week, right, you remember that Trump has stopped with whoever. The U.S. has stopped. Trump said it wasn't him. He didn't know about it. But it would be surprising, right? It stopped shipments of absolutely vital weapons, including missiles for Patriots, air defense systems, to Ukraine, as Ukraine is basically running out of specifically those weapons. Mm. So those are defensive weapons. They are absolutely vital to protect civilian population. And Russia, at the same time, is increasing both the intensity of attacks, its own production of Shahed-type drones and missiles.
Yeah, increasing. Two killed overnight, and every neighborhood of Kyiv apparently was targeted.
Targeted, and a lot of over the last 2 weeks, especially this huge wave of attacks, of reinforced attacks. So we have seen really a lot of more victims. That two per night is already a lot for the families. But we have seen also nights when there were tens and scores of victims. We have seen residential neighborhoods really damaged and buildings damaged. And also at the same time, Russia is also employing a different tactic in the south, especially in Kherson. These are small drones which hunt individual people. So this is a drone hunt. And in the face of this, what we have is an absolute lethargic U.S. Administration, which is showing no sign of reanimating itself.
I want to get back to the U.S.'s calculus in all of this. But first, General Trinquant, The last time that we had war in Europe for this long was in the 1990s in the former Yugoslavia. Back then, it was a civil war.
Yeah,
And it was it was different from this. This is an invasion of a sovereign state, and it seems to have no end. How do you compare the two events now? When you
no comparison, if you look at the attack by the Russia to Ukraine. It's a real war. I mean, they are using all weapon systems that they can use against the population and against the soldier on the front line. In Yugoslavia, you had first people coming from the Serb army, which were trying to oppress others, and others wanted to be free. And Europeans were present, but they were just looking at what's happening, making reports, and sometimes defending some villages and things like that. But they were present.
Yeah.
So they were present, which is something we can discuss about what's happened in London, the presence of European troops in Ukraine, which is not the case currently. But I mean that Russia initially wanted to have a very fast, very short, not war, pressure in Ukraine. They lost their chance, and now they've got to fight, and they want to fight, and this happened for the three last years, and they are using all possible weapons in order to suppress and to pressure the Ukrainian population and soldier.
And the threat is felt, obviously, directly for Ukrainians, but in a more diffuse manner for the rest of Europe. Calling cards have been sent. Back in March, the Associated Press compiled 59 instances of sabotage attributed to Russia since February of 2022 inside of the European Union and in the UK. Everything from hacks to last year's London warehouse fire and the cutting of cables in the Baltic Sea. Yeah, this is some of what was compiled. It includes Norway as well, there, as you see. Now, back in the days of the Cold War, the pushback to all of that would have been led by the United States. It financed outlets like Radio Free Europe. It put allies under the protection of its nuclear umbrella. Now, with NATO standing on unsure footing, one of the two big announcements of the day coming out of that NATO base in England, where France's Emmanuel Macron concluded a state visit with a joint announcement with Britain's Keir Starmer.
Now, as Europe's only nuclear powers, and as leaders in NATO, we play a vital role in preserving the peace and security on this continent. We signed the Northwood Declaration, confirming for the first time that we are coordinating our independent nuclear deterrence. From today, our adversaries will know that any extreme threat to this continent would prompt a response from our two nations.
Giuseppe Spatafora, how do you interpret what you just heard? Does it mean that now Europe is under a joint Franco-British nuclear umbrella?
Well, look, the interesting part of this is that historically, one country, especially France, had kept its own nuclear deterrent very under short control, because they didn't want to basically participate in the NATO nuclear sharing agreement. They're not even part of it right now. And instead, the UK was part and is still part. So it's quite interesting to see that these two countries have now agreed to that basically they cannot see threats separated. The threats to one country, the vital interest of one country, will also be the vital interest of the others. And this connects to the long-term French posture to suggest that France's vital interests have a European component. So that's a very interesting development. Of course, in all this, the nuclear deterrent will continue to be very much under the control of the two sovereign nations, but it does help in the context of the dwindling US commitment to Europe. Now, it's interesting that the US has said, including Secretary Exits, that they will not reduce or withdraw the nuclear deterrent from Europe. But of course, the fact that they are wondering about reducing the conventional deterrence to Europe does ask question as to what extent the nuclear deterrent from the US is serious. Because of course, if the US is not willing to send troops to potentially fight an aggressor in Europe, why would they use nuclear weapons? That's a classic question. Would the US sacrifice Washington for Paris? So in that context, it's very helpful that the UK and France make this statement. It's very helpful in the context of a potential reduced deterrence against Russia. Of course, from that, you also need to connect to all the other attempts that are being done to strengthen European conventional deterrence. And of course, also hybrid attacks, because you were talking about hybrid attacks, and that's basically an area in which European forces are tested almost every day. So it's part of a continuum. And it's important I see that the significance comes from that, comes from the fact that there is an adversary in Europe to be deterred, and at the same time, the US commitment, even though right now the position of Ukraine may be changing, but still, it's clearly much more uncertain compared to a few months ago.
Is this just an announcement, General Trinquant?
No, not at all. Up to now, the deterrence in Europe was made by NATO with a cell, nuclear planning cell, which was run by the US, in fact, because the weapons were US. And you had, in addition, the French deterrence, which was a national one. For the first time, you've got two countries who have the national possibility of having nuclear weapons who are planning them without the U.S.
Yeah, but the British still have their Trident submarines. They still have the U.S. F-35s.
Yeah, sure. The autonomy from France and from U.K. is not the same. But anyway, you will have a cell, a nuclear cell, where the British and the French will work together without the American. Doesn't mean that the American will not be in the loop, of course, because of the nuclear, the UK nuclear power, which is linked to the US. But that means they will work together and not in the cell under the command of the US, because in the nuclear cell in NATO, it's in fact the US who are driving the thing because they are providing the weapons.
Anastasia Shapochkina, you agree this is a milestone moment, perhaps? Mm.
We'll have to see if it's a milestone moment, and I really truly hope that General Trinquant is right and that it means that France and the UK will actually work together. I don't know how, on nuclear deterrence, I don't know how much it's possible for the UK to work without the US or without the US command. I understand that they are entirely dependent on the US for any decision making they can take, but what really worries me is that this combination can be used in the same way as the whole coalition of the willing, you know, conventional talk has been between France and the UK in the last weeks, when France declared itself ready to go and position its troops in theory in Ukraine, and then said, well, but we are not going to do it alone. That doesn't make any sense. Let us go see the British. And the British said, we are not interested in going. And then the French came back and said, we are not going to go alone. And this was about a conventional, just troops positioning in a hypothetical future situation. They were not going right away. Now we are talking here about something, 10 times greater, 100 times greater. It is a capacity of two leaders of two completely different independent countries to decide whether they, each of them, is going to push a button or not, and one of them will still have to ask the US whether they can push the button. And I'm afraid that this is going to be used in right away in a situation in which we are in now, when Poland is going around the European Union asking who is going to, for example, be the next person to hold the nuclear umbrella. And when it turns to France, France is going to, instead of saying yes or no, now say to Poles, wait a second, I'm going to turn to my friend Keir Starmer, and Keir Starmer is going to say, wait a second, I'm going to turn to Donald Trump.
But the French president fielded that question. He said, I'm not going to go into specifics of that. He kept the strategic ambiguity on that.
Of course, we should keep the strategic ambiguity, but that's when also the strategic kind of undeterminedness is entering, right? For those people who need, like Poland and other countries in the European Union, wondering about what is the new level of protection that does not give the clarity the U.S. had offered.
All right. Could it weaken, in fact, the deterrence instead of strengthening it?
No, I don't think so. I mean, since the beginning, the French have always said that they've got their autonomous deterrence weapons, in addition to the NATO one.
But the specific example here given about Poland, for instance, if Poland says, hey, we need your help here.
There are
currently discussions with the German, we're the first one, who say, we are interested and we want to discuss. And the Polish said, we are interested and we want to discuss. So the problem is that initially the French president present that to the other Europeans. Say, you know, French deterrence could be useful for all European countries. Fine. Now we are in another procedure where we are talking with the second country who has the weapon system. And to say, okay, we'll do that together. Not only the French, but the British and the French together. And I agree that we don't know what's the... I'm pretty sure that even if the French want to use the nuclear power, they will discuss with the American, of course. But doesn't mean that they don't have the decision. It means that they will discuss, but they can use it without the
agreement. French for sure. The French for sure. The UK cannot. The French can, of course.
All right. And the nuclear deterrence, just one aspect of it. Macron and Starmer phoning in to a coalition of the Willing Alliance summit that took place at the same time in Rome, where it was in the presence of Volodymyr Zelensky and Donald Trump's envoy, Keith Kellogg, with leaders bending over backwards, thanking him for showing up. Some of the starkest language, and perhaps not the same kind of language you hear from Emmanuel Macron talking about strategic autonomy, instead came from Germany's new chancellor.
I have two messages. The one goes to Moscow and to President Putin. The message is quite simple. We will not give up. And dear friends, my second message goes to Washington, D.C. and to President Donald Trump. Stay with us and stay with the Europeans. We are on the same page.
Elena Voloshin, your reaction to those words?
I'm thinking about how Russian propaganda fiercely attacked Friedrich Merz all over the past weeks because of treating him as a Nazi and so on. Although he was not like the more active in Europe, let's say, behind Macron to deliver some missiles and so on to Ukraine. So I'm quite, you know, like not surprised, but glad maybe to hear that Friedrich Merz is now becoming so combative, maybe because he was like a target.
And that appeal to Donald Trump saying, stay with us. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah. But I think he thinks like just the European side of it may be like still too weak. I mean, we see the Germans being very, very, very cautious since the beginning of this war in any initiative and still not delivering the towers missiles to Ukraine. So I think he's like... He doesn't want to engage too much, but now there is a step ahead at least with the words.
Giuseppe Spatafora, Germany and Italy, losers in the Second World War, and after the war, they handed over their security architecture to the Americans with military bases that to remain to this day with the nuclear umbrella. They're the two countries that have the most to lose if Washington disengages from the continent. Your thoughts on Merz's language versus Macron's language?
Well, the ones, in my opinion, that have the most to lose if from a complete U.S. withdrawal are the ones that are the closest to the Russian front line, because they would be the next one. But of course, we're in a system of alliances in which those countries also, you know, our security cannot be separated. Interestingly enough, when you said that Germany, you know, after World War II, Merz made that same claim, but it was in the context of reconstruction, saying that reconstruction after the war helped Germany reach the economic miracle. And he was hoping for that to happen to Ukraine. But anyway, returning to the main point, I think that just like others, this Italy and Germany have been really struck by the changes in U.S. attitude, but they've taken different routes. I think Germany, especially after the election of Merz, have been very clear in language and apparently also with votes, with the decision to release the debt brake, that they would contribute actively to European defense and they would try to make Europe as self-sufficient as possible. But as Merz says today, clearly this will not happen overnight and the US commitment is still needed. So it's even though Europe is doing more, it cannot deter Russia on its own as of today. And Putin at least believes that Europe cannot deter Russia on its own. And then Italy has struck a different chord, because perhaps because of the ideological position of Giorgia Meloni, but also because she has always been an Atlanticist in her foreign policy position, both with Biden and with Trump. She really pushes the Europeans not to move away from the United States, to stay close. And in fact, when she went to the White House a few months ago, she pledged that Italy would reach 2% of GDP in spending, but then they would also spend it on U.S. weapons. And that was a way of making sure that Trump would not get mad at some sort of protections. And of course, this is a reality that will continue to take place.
Is that very different from Germany?
Many. Yeah, I think it is, because Germany has taken a different stance over the past few months. Yes, Merz just said, Donald Trump, don't leave us. He's also saying it to push him to keep in this anti-Putin rhetoric that he's taken over the past few days, which may not last, but we'll see. But in practice, Germany has done a lot in terms of starting to prepare for war in terms of, you know, deterrence by spending a lot. Italy has done much less, also because it is in a tougher situation. Germany is a much better fiscal situation, and the population, despite Russian propaganda, I think is more open to spending for defense. In Italy, it's much harder. So they actually, if you see a recent survey, Italians are by far the most worried about moving money away from social spending towards defense. They really don't like it. So Italy has to tread this more carefully. And of course, keeping the U.S. in is a way of avoiding making those potentially necessary sacrifices. So there is a difference.
Anastasia Shapochkina?
To me, the positive in this kind of show of support to Ukraine over the two meetings, right, in London and in Rome, is the two messages, if we can say it. One is the message to Putin, because no matter what they're saying and how much afraid they are of the U.S. in the leaving, obviously, with a whole bunch of weapons nobody can replace at this time, these four countries, Germany, France, Italy, and the U.K., also happen to be the biggest military industry countries in Europe. And their faces, their photo ops with Zelensky, their continuous, you know, kind of throwing themselves behind him, like this kind of show sends a message to Vladimir Putin. And then on the other hand, it sends a message to Donald Trump. I think the meeting between Starmer and Macron, for example, if it does one thing, it shows that at least the European countries are starting to imagine the worst case scenario and starting preparing for it. They maybe cannot prepare overnight, but they are thinking about it in addition to being afraid. They are not just now being afraid and are begging with Trump to remain. As they are being afraid and begging, they're also starting to think.
Let's go over just a few of the bullet points, which are actually quite significant here if they come to be. First of all, they're talking about after a ceasefire, but still, you would have up to 50,000 soldiers from a Franco-British force that could be used in Ukraine in some way. They're talking about a no-fly zone in Ukraine. And they're talking about, from Friday, the setting up of the headquarters of this coalition of the willing here in Paris. General Tancon, how far will this concept go?
I will start by the end, the headquarters. Because, as you know, 15 years ago with the Lancaster House Agreement, there was an agreement that...
The bilateral agreement between France and the UK.
There will be a joint headquarters for a brigade, for expeditionary forces. Now, things have changed. It's no longer expeditionary forces, it's the defense of Europe. It's no longer a brigade headquarters, it's a corps headquarters. A corps headquarters means 50,000 troops, roughly, and with several divisions. So they are preparing for that. They are planning for that. Up to now, I'm not sure that they've got the 50,000 soldiers.
Yeah, there was Emmanuel Macron who had to skirt a question about whether or not this means conscription is coming back. The same question they're asking in Germany. Are you going to have to draft young men and possibly women into the army?
So the first point is it is not a Franco-British corps. It's a European corps where the French and the British are at the headquarters, are running all that. To have the 50,000 soldiers, we have a problem in Europe. Currently, to enlist soldiers, with the French army, we are able to enlist the soldiers we need today. Germany, for example, is not able to do it. And so when we are planning that, we're saying, okay, who will provide what? France say, okay, a brigade, 10,000, we can do that. We've got that. The British, I would say, aircraft, navy, perhaps. Poland say, fine, but in Poland, rear area, will not go in Ukraine, which is useful, but not useful in terms of soldier deploy. So we are still planning all that. And to plan that, you need to have an headquarters who will work together. I've been in a Franco-British force in Yugoslavia in 1995. You start planning when you are together. Mm. So you need to do that and ask Danes, German, Poland, all, what are you providing? Air defense, aircraft, naval, infantry, tanks. You put all together and then you say, we are able to do that in 1 month, 2 months, 3 months. But we must just remember that for almost all the European countries have been disarming for years, for 20 years. And now we ask them suddenly to go back. You know, in 1990, when I was in Baden-Baden, 2nd French Corps, we were able to do all that. It was 30 years ago.
And you still had compulsory military service.
We're no longer able to
France.
Do it. Yeah. And we need time to rebuild all that.
Giuseppe Spatafore, very briefly on this point. If Vladimir Putin's looking at this now, he's thinking, well, they don't even have enough soldiers. Are we going to see a lot more conscription right now in Europe? Are we going to see the draft? Are we going to see military service coming back? We saw the Danes, for instance, allowing women into the army.
Well, there's a variety of options for sure. There have been, and each country has its own context, right? I think that countries such as the Baltics or the Nordic countries, they will find it easier to find people who are ready to fight or at least to participate in the system of total defense, and whereby civilian participants, civilian people participate in the war effort in one way or another. For other countries such as my own, it will be harder in a way. But the point is, one thing that General Tronchard said was important. He said, all of a sudden we have to do it. Of course, people from Ukraine, but also from other countries in Central Eastern Europe, that will tell us, no, the signs have been coming for a long time. At least since 2022, but somebody would say at least since 2014 that we had to do it. So, of course, there's a problem of adaptation. In the meanwhile, I think that Germany ended conscription in 2010, and then all this happened. Clearly, if the direction of travel was that one, and there could be calls as to whether this could have been done earlier. It won't be easy. It again goes back to questions that I said before, that there might be trade-offs, and that Russian propaganda will seize on this. But, there's the solution will not be one. I think every European country will sort of choose its own. And one last point, if I may make, around about the 50,000 force, or anyway, the force for Ukraine. You say it's after a ceasefire. That's the fundamental point, because Europeans were not ready to send any forces while the war still goes on, and also without a U.S. backstop. But right now, when we talk about the ceasefire, you were asking me about Vladimir Putin. Putin is saying, okay, basically, my main goal is to continue fighting this war, because any ceasefire will not, will lead to something else. For instance, European troops in Ukraine, which is something that he absolutely does not want. So, again, we can see that his strategy is still to double down on continuing to attack Ukraine, which is why on our side, I think the key part is to really provide Ukraine with the key means to defend itself, even before this coalition of the willing, which is important, but will only come after a ceasefire.
And in Washington, as Anastasia Shepochkina was pointing out at the start of the show, the calculus is different. Donald Trump still holding out hope that Russia will come to the bargaining table. On that score, his Secretary of State meeting his Russian counterpart this Thursday on the sidelines of an ASEAN meeting in Kuala Lumpur for what Marco Rubio dubbed a frank discussion, where he shared the U.S. president's frustration. On that score, there was a bit of an awkward moment on Tuesday when reporters asked Donald Trump about his suspension of some military aid to Ukraine.
Last week, the Pentagon paused some shipments of weapons to Ukraine. Did you approve of that pause?
We want to put defensive weapons because Putin is not He's not treating human beings right. He's killing too many people. So we're sending some defensive weapons to Ukraine, and I've approved that.
So who ordered the pause last week?
I don't know. What did you tell me?
All right. The man next to him, his defense secretary, Pete Hegseth, had a lot to do with it, it seems. Anastasia Shepochkina, is it possible that the defense secretary, as has been reported by U.S. media, went rogue?
Well, it'd be really surprising because he was hired and he's being kept just for the simple reason that he is not going rogue any time in his life. He's absolutely dependent on Trump. He has such legacy in his previous performance that obviously not very hireable after this. And
I sense skepticism in your voice.
And these are the decisions which are not only passed by the presidential administration, but also by Congress. And so they have passed, you know, before. And so, yeah, this is very doubtful that just a Secretary of Defense, especially this particular secretary, would take any type of initiative like this. But what we are rather witnessing, I think, is this kind of dichotomy that Trump has exhibited since his first term, right? On the one hand, is this continuous commitment to Russia, pretty much, in everything he
commitment
does.
Commitment to Russia?
Commitment to Russia, to Russia's agenda, to Vladimir Putin, who he personally admires.
And Alina's nodding.
And I completely agree, yeah. It's a fact. It's not an opinion, it's an obvious fact.
And then on the other hand is this kind of necessity to be American president.
What do you mean by commitment to Russia?
He doesn't manage to cope. I would leave to Elena.
He doesn't consider Russia as the aggressor in this war. It's as simple as that. As fool as it can sound to us, but there are other things going on in Washington today which are completely crazy. But he just does not consider that Putin started this war. He thinks that it's the Biden's fault who did not manage to negotiate with Putin. So that's it.
And this whole Russian... Russian discourse, including diplomatic discourse, official diplomatic discourse, about the fact that NATO started the war, that's pretty much what Trump is. He's half in it if he doesn't believe it entirely. And that's what he believes, because back then it was Biden in office and hence. And it works very well. And there are now books written about the relationship between Trump and Russia for a very long time, for the last 45 years. But at the same time, he's faced with this necessity to perform as an American president, as he was faced during the first term. And thus he continuously disappoints the Kremlin's expectations at the same time. So we're not witnessing there something new like, oh, this is his personality today. It is not even maybe personality related. There are these certain loyalties that we're observing for whatever reason, but on the other hand, some preferences or beliefs, but on the other hand, incapacity to fulfill them to the level of expectations of the Kremlin because he is still burdened with the office that he is upholding.
At the end of the day, how does this movie end, Dmitry Tykon? Does he side with the Pentagon or does he side with the MAGA base?
No, but I think that Mr. Trump wanted to have an agreement, a peace, something, to stop the war. And that's it. And after 6 months, he is realizing that nothing will happen like that with Putin. And so slowly he's moving in the words, I want to see actions now. Because he just... for example, decided that the weapon will be shell and missiles, but in fact they want air defense system, they want Patriot. And Mr. Trump saying it's very expensive, you know, I don't know if I can give it. So slowly the words from Mr. Trump are changing because of Mr. Putin, because Mr. Putin never listened to what he's saying to him.
Elena Volochin, expecting on this actions. Point. Why doesn't Vladimir Putin just say, yes, have a 30-day ceasefire?
Why would he? He has...
because if he gets a 30-day ceasefire, then Donald Trump will have an argument for ridding himself of everything and giving him what he wants.
What I can see right now is that all that discussions don't put on the table one single claim to Vladimir Putin. Even though the Europeans, they want a ceasefire, but on one base... What reason would have Vladimir Putin today to follow any ceasefire? He has his own agenda, and Starmer and Macron Merz are starting to speaking today Putin's language by speaking by force. They don't put any claims on Putin. They don't don't have any diplomatical agenda. He says we are arming. We are also having a deterrence nuclear strategy. So this is speaking Vladimir Putin's language, whereas Donald Trump, him, is still speaking his own language which belongs only to him. Not the diplomatical, nothing, just I want a ceasefire. That Vladimir Putin, he has his agenda. He wants to conquest the areas of Ukraine.
But wouldn't he get what he wants faster if he first agreed to a 30-day ceasefire? It would please Donald Trump.
It will be all of the same to Vladimir Putin. He has now, again, his military operation going on. He's in force on the ground. He's gaining territories. He has nothing to lose. He has no sanctions threatening him. I mean, everything's fine for Vladimir Putin right now. He will have 30,000 or so more North Korean soldiers being sent to Russia. So everything, I mean, he's producing a lot of weapons, a lot of drones. The economy has not collapsed. So Vladimir Putin has no reason whatsoever right now to follow any plan, peace plan. And we don't see even any peace plan, neither on the European side, neither on the American side.
Everything's fine. I mean, Russia does have a new transport minister. His name is Andrei Nikitin. He was approved by the Russian parliament on Tuesday, one day after the sacking of his predecessor, Roman Starovoyt, who was then found dead in Moscow of an apparent suicide. No official explanation for the dismissal of Starovoyt, the former governor of the Kursk region that borders Ukraine.
The official order does not say there has been a loss of trust in Starovoyt. There is no such wording in the text, and I have nothing else to say in this case. This is a decision of the head of state.
Giuseppe Spatafora, is this just domestic politics? Or does this have something to do with that special military operation, as Vladimir Putin calls it?
Well, I don't have the expertise to comment on Russian domestic politics per se, so I would defer it to a colleague. I would guess that there's probably something to do about the military operation, simply because this is so essential to the regime's own way of power. I believe that that's a connection, but again, I wouldn't comment on that. I would return at some point, if you want, on the U.S., on the struggles inside the White House, but I would defer to colleagues on answering this.
All right, Elena Volyshyn, you singled out an excerpt for your Scene from Russia segment from an interview by exiled economist and politician Vladimir Milov. He told Dozhd TV that the case of Roman Starovoyt highlights what he calls a paradox. You're allowed to steal if you're a Kremlin insider, but not from the transport budget or military fortifications.
They cannot not steal because the whole system is built around this. But looting creates problems. Those problems have to be solved. And how are they solving them? With guns in the forest.
With guns in the forest.
Yeah, because he was found in his car around Moscow with a bullet in the head. So this is where the
everybody thinks it was an assassination.
No, I wouldn't say everybody. They are debating whether it was a suicide because he did not want to go into Putin's prison because he most probably would be accused of détournement de fonds.
Money laundering.
Thank you. The question was, is it related to the so-called special operation, the war in Ukraine? It is in the extent that the money laundering was on the budget, which was designed to put fortifications, anti-tank fortifications on the border with Ukraine. And he was governor to this region when the budget was allowed, and then he was named Ministry of Transport. And his successor has been arrested, accused of stealing 1 billion rubles from
and the same Kursk region where the Ukrainians marched
exactly,
in last
exactly.
August.
So probably the rumor says that his successor was testifying against him, and he was targeted with being sued after for money laundering. So whether he commits his suicide, whether he was assassinated by some people who did not want to get involved in the scandal, this is the purpose for the debate right now among
Anastasia Shepherdskina. Again, is this proof that, well, that it does sting Ukraine's operation? It is affecting the Kremlin.
I think definitely Kremlin wasn't happy about Ukraine entering Kursk. It didn't only cause uplifting in Ukraine, it also caused a concern in Russia. And for me, this is more like, if we take a step back, you know, this is more a sign that not everything is amazing. You know, not everything is quiet in Baghdad, as the Russian expression goes. And this is a sign of the system, which is obviously, you know, struggling with itself. The elites, which now have been sent a signal, because corruption is not something that, you know, Vladimir Putin is definitely not well positioned to fight corruption, to be a corruption, anti-corruption kind of flag bearer, because obviously we had seen all the Navalny investigations over years, right? He's one of the most corrupt people in Russia. But what it sends as a signal to his own elites is that, be afraid of me. If there is ever, you know, a thought of a potential, you know, whatever, that know that I have control. And if you manage, if you move the wrong way, whichever way it may be, you are just going to get the bullet in the head. And I think that really shows, if that's the language you as a leader need to communicate to your team, let's say, or to your vassals, to your surrounding, then of course it means that you are maybe not very confident yourself. And then, because there are other ways to deal, you know, with corruption, and it shows also that, you know, the mood, I guess, as well, because when people inside Russia, they see this, they must see, you know, who are in the same position, maybe the successor of the transportation minister, the other ministers, they're getting a signal, you know, what is this environment, and what is their own that is their own kind of role in it. And what I want to also place it more in larger context, also, this is not just about the elites, right, struggle within the elites. To me, it's also the reflecting of a larger, you know, developments, because this week, also in last week, we have seen a wave of arrests also within the civil society, right? Yet another wave of arrests, including people being charged with treason, you know, and being put in prison, you know, from
and so that working. Happens every time the Kremlin feels it's done.
It's been happening for the last, you know, right, you know, over a decade now. But in a sense, that this shows that, you know, the war is not just, you know, absolutely has no damage for Russia. It's just basically, yes, the economy can continue. Yes, you know, they are developing a lot of weapons. They have great allies, but there is a strain, and we can hold. And that strain continues. We don't know how
is being felt. We began this show with that terrifying sound of that drone that hit Kyiv overnight. After that barrage, we mentioned how, well, people got up in the morning, cleaned up, and this Thursday went about their daily lives.
We're coping. I just came to have a coffee. We have no other choice other than to cope. We haven't fled, we're still working, we're still paying taxes, and we're working.
I had a cold shower, drank two coffees, sat and thought for a while, understood that at this particular moment, there is nothing I can do, so I just went to work, that's it.
At the end of the day, after the announcements in Rome, in England, Ukrainians feel a little bit less all on their own?
I don't know if that's the level of support Ukrainians are needing at this point. They need to move the people to move beyond the announcements, really. But I think what we see really makes a difference is the resilience of the defense industry inside, the continuous development of the defense industry, Ukrainian defense industry, and those people who work in it and who work for the development, for strengthening their defense, own defense capabilities. They are not at all depressed. They are not at all put to fear and not at all influenced by the decisions of the U.S. in their moral state and in their readiness to continue their own work, which is extremely important. We also had several important developments this last week, for example, the development of Ukrainian Cub, which is now operational, the developments in the automation of drones as well, and robotic systems, which are important as well. So that, I think, is the biggest hope that Ukrainians realize now they have. Themselves.
Right. We'll have to leave it there for now. I want to thank you, Anastasia Shapochkina. I want to thank General Dominique Trinquant and Lena Voloshin. I also want to thank Giuseppe Spatafora for being with us from Brussels. Thank you for being with us here in the France 24 debate.